In this edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, part two of our series on imperialism, which is the highest stage of capitalism.
If you can randomly kill Chinese on the streets over here, that means we're ready to kill massive amounts of Chinese over there.
As the economies of the U.S. and those of other former colonizers in Europe face multiple crises at home, we examine their aggression toward this century's fastest growing economy, China.
But sanctions are war. They are just as deadly as bullets and bombs, but the damage and deaths are not as visible to those who are outside the country.
Also, what is the impact of war, hybrid war, including economic sanctions, used to maintain capitalism's hegemony around the globe?
So hunger has become an instrument of war, and food responding to that artificially created hunger is an instrument of war.
And finally, what does U.S. aggression and its doctrine of so-called great power competition mean for the formerly colonized of Asia, Central and South America, and Africa? From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Esther Ivarum. And we're going to launch this second installment of our series on imperialism, on the role of U.S.-led wars and militarism, with the international human rights activist Ajamu Baraka, national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace and former Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. Welcome to the show, Ajamu.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's a whole big world out here and so many ways we could dive into this topic. But let's start with your reaction to the recent G7 summit, where President Biden enlisted support from the world's former colonizers, as I like to call them, to counter China's economic rise. And then NATO, which is led by the U.S., issued a statement that China's economic and military might is a threat that must be confronted, even though China poses no military threat to Europe or the U.S.
This was Biden's attempt to try to refashion the Atlantic Alliance. You know, Biden refers to himself as an Atlanticist, which is really a fancy word for white supremacist. His objective was to bring America back, quote unquote, to attempt to try to reassert U.S. leadership in the international arena by gathering around him the other top European powers with Japan to suggest that they have more in common and have a greater need to work together than to allow themselves to be working against each other. And it was, I think, fairly successful, even though there's great skepticism among those nations. And from there, he went to NATO to try to bolster that alliance. And we see NATO as an aggressive white supremacist structure. And they are continuing with the Trump initiative, which is to commit to increasing NATO spending, because they see NATO as a valuable structure to use to try to maintain and advance U.S. and European hegemony. So all of this was in anticipation to the meeting with Putin and the tough guy sort of image that Biden is trying to advance vis-a-vis Putin. But we know that the real agenda of that meeting is to set the stage for attempting to do what Trump really wanted to do, which was to try to bring Putin back into the community of European nations as part of a united front against the Chinese.
And at the end of that summit with Putin, I was struck, and I'm sure many people were, about the comment about how would the world feel if the U.S. was interfering in elections around the world.
Let's get this straight. How would it be if the United States were viewed by the rest of the world as interfering with the elections directly of other countries and everybody knew it?
I was like, does he really believe this? Does his neocon advisors really believe that the world doesn't know that the U.S. has intervened in dozens of countries around the world during the last 60 years? But I couldn't be sure if this was just a lack of self-awareness, a lack of understanding of history, or whether he thinks everyone else is just ignorant.
You know, it may be all of the above. I think there's some kind of strange sort of psychopathology when it comes to some U.S. policymakers. They actually cannot even cognitively see the double standards that they operate in. And so they don't really see their interventions as really interventions. And that's why they can't see the connection between the concern they had with the possibility of Trump not leaving office at the end of his term. And then as soon as Biden comes into office, he gives the green light to Jovenel Moïse to stay as the president in Haiti. So they don't see those kinds of contradictions. And that's why it's so important that we point those things out, but also so important for people to understand that because of their worldviews, we cannot really expect them to address any of the issues that we see as important domestically and in the international arena.
I wanted to know if you could sketch us a little outline about how the U.S. has ramped up its military presence and activity around the globe after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because we have the U.S. intervention in the elections in Russia. We have these series of Middle East wars that the U.S. has invaded. And it seems that the U.S. was very comfortable at that point being this so-called unipolar power. And during that same time, China has risen economically, you know, not involved in these endless wars, and has created economic alliances around the world through its Belt and Road Initiative. So you have one country building economic alliances, and you have the United States and NATO on these endless military excursions. And I shouldn't say excursions, I should say invasions and really destructions of countries around the world.
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting question, because what you pointed out is something that we have to remind ourselves of. And that is that, you know, we might recall, some of us are old enough to remember that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was some brief discussion around the possibility of some kind of peace dividend, if you will, that in fact, the world would be a much more peaceful place with one superpower in charge. But that notion of peace was quickly dispensed with. Military spending continued. In fact, it continued to expand. And the U.S. felt no hesitation in attempting to impose its will on any nation it felt that it wanted to impose itself on. Without any countervailing power, what we saw, instead of a more peaceful world, was a more dangerous one. And the kind of reckless activity that we saw beginning in the middle and late 1990s with the bombings of Serbia continued with the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan in the early 2000s. So this has been part of the playbook once the U.S. found itself as the sole superpower on the planet, that they were going to use their military superiority to galvanize their power and to put into place a situation where they would be unchallenged. That's why they came up with the strategy of full spectrum dominance. It became the central component of their national security strategy to control the entire globe and to make sure that there was no threats to their hegemony in any of the regions. So this has been their strategy. It's been reflected in their national defense strategy, reflected in the 2018 national defense strategy of Donald Trump that identified Russia and China as major competitors and international threats. It is the cornerstone of their military budget and military spending and their commitment to engage in activity like upgrading their nuclear weapons. So this is part of the threat that collective humanity sees coming from the U.S. You're right. They have been committed to using military force to advance their interests. And as a consequence, all of us now are facing real existential threats coming from this uncontrollable power that we call the United States of America.
That might be a good way to at least briefly talk about the Global South, Africa, and Central and South America and other parts of Asia, because when the Soviet Union was in existence, it not only was a countervailing global military power, but it also lent assistance to emerging liberation movements around the world, to Cuba, for example, in our own hemisphere. And so without that assistance, many liberation movements, formerly colonized countries, have had to exist in this world where the United States has so much ability to not only directly wage war, but to engage in what we call hybrid war. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the demonstrations that I've joined you here in Washington, D.C., for example, in defense of Venezuela. And you mentioned Haiti before that. So from where you sit in terms of your own organizing, what are some of the impact that you've seen from the U.S. in these emerging economies as people, you know, seek their own sovereignty and their liberation in their own countries?
Well, you know, as a consequence of the commitment on the part of the U.S. state to maintain its global hegemony, both militarily and economically, that has generated a counterforce. And that is that the people in the global South who have been suffering from neoliberal capitalist policies for the last 40 years have been involved in a counter struggle to try to recapture for themselves their national sovereignty, control over their economic resources and their economic and social life. And we've seen that emerge in places throughout Latin America and the Caribbean with very powerful social movements. And sometimes those social movements ended up taking political power in places like Venezuela and Bolivia, and for a while in Ecuador. Yeah, and of course, we have the continuation of Cuba and Nicaragua. And so even though they suffered some reversals over the last few years, we see that momentum coming from the bottom up, coming from the people who want to see real structural change. It continues. And so we see a rebound taking place in places like Peru and the recapturing of power in Bolivia after a U.S.-inspired coup. So the desperation on the part of Europe and the U.S. to try to maintain their global hegemony through military dominance has been met with the counterforce of the organized people throughout this hemisphere and really throughout the world. So we have a much more dangerous world, but also a much more hopeful world because people have been able to feel their power, to see what they can do once they are organized. And once that takes place, and it's taking place every day, the U.S. is quickly finding, as they found in Afghanistan and Iraq and even in Syria, that military power does not automatically translate into political dominance.
Well, that is probably a good place to stop. I've been joined by Ajamu Baraka, national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace and former Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. Thank you for joining me, Ajamu.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. So what are sanctions? Technically, they're commercial and financial penalties applied by one or more countries against another government, group, or individual. They can include restrictions on trade, as the United States has imposed on Iran, Cuba, North Korea, Syria, Zimbabwe, and 14 other countries. These trade restrictions often prohibit countries, including non-sanctioned countries, from also trading with the targeted country. If they don't do that, they risk being sanctioned themselves. Sanctions can take the form of blocked financial transactions, not allowing financial institutions to process them. And this prevents a government, group, or individual from doing business, buying goods or services outside of the country. A government can also freeze the assets of another country or entity, as the United States did to Venezuela in August 2019 in an executive order signed by President Trump. A government can also sanction by reducing foreign aid that's typically given, as the U.S. did to Palestine, stopping its funding for the United Nations Palestinian Relief. It can also block loans through U.S.-dominated institutions like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. And the Global Magnitsky Act of 2016 allows the U.S. government to block travel to the United States or revoke the U.S. visa of any person the U.S. deems as a human rights violator or corrupt. And this has been used against individuals from China, Russia, Ukraine, and other countries. Most often, the U.S. uses sanctions as a tool to overthrow governments it doesn't support. The goal is to impose economic hardship on a country, or quote unquote, make the economy scream, as they said about Chile, claim the government of that country is responsible for the hardship, and encourage the population to rise up in protest against its government. The manufactured and often U.S.-supported opposition is used to justify more U.S. intervention to demand that the government step down, or a coup may be conducted. Sanctions are also used as retaliation to undermine the efforts of countries to move toward more independence or develop non-capitalist economies. And also, sanctions were used on members of the International Criminal Court in retaliation for proceeding with an investigation of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. Sanctions are illegal. The ones that are imposed by the United States violate international laws and the U.S. Constitution.
Military and monetary. Military and monetary. Military and monetary. Get together whenever they think it's necessary. They have turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning parts of the planet into a cemetery. What you gonna do? Military and monetary. Military and monetary.
Say, what you gonna do?
We hounded the Ayatollah religiously. Bombed Libya and killed Gaddafi's son hideously.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Esther Averam. The voices in the last segment included Gil Scott-Heron performing Work for Peace and Dr. Margaret Flowers on a webinar produced by the Sanctions Kill Coalition at sanctionskill.org. Now, new and ongoing economic sanctions by the U.S. and the EU against China are part of a war campaign being waged against the world's fastest growing economy, according to KJ Ngo. He is the special senior correspondent for the Asia Pacific on KPFA's Flashpoints program and a writer for Counterpunch, Monthly Review, Black Agenda Report, Dissident Voice, and other progressive publications. Here is KJ Ngo's conversation with Pacifica producer Ken Yale.
In this century, we are increasingly seeing a U.S. empire that is in decline, and the empire is now targeting China, Russia, and Iran as its greatest enemies. There's not a single day that goes by anymore without a corporate news story that bashes China or a pronouncement by a U.S. government official that demonizes China as the greatest threat to the U.S. and to the free world, whatever that means. So, KJ, why is the U.S. empire now targeting China as its number one enemy?
The key point that we need to understand is that the U.S. is at war with China, and it's actually escalating towards a shooting war. After the fall of the USSR, the U.S. wanted unipolar global hegemony, and what became very clear and obvious was that there was not only a viable alternate pole of development, a non-Western, non-capitalist model of development, but that it was outpacing and outmatching the imperialist center and creating different possibilities for the world. That's when this plan to take down China took on a very, very earnest tone. And that's when we started to see, quote unquote, the pivot to Asia.
How do you see the nature of that non-capitalist, non-Western development? Because obviously there's huge debate about, is China state capitalist? Is it socialist? Is it imperialist?
China is not socialist yet. It's a state that is moving towards socialism. And you don't jump from feudalism directly into socialism. There is an intermediary process where wealth has to be accrued and the means of production have to be leveraged. And this involves a transition through capitalism. So China is undergoing a kind of state-controlled or state-planned dirigist capitalism. They say that within 30 years, we plan to create the beginnings of a socialist state for all our people. I think just on the most basic level, during the 40 years that the United States has waged endless war and seen the earning power of its working class flatline, China has brought 850 million people out of poverty, and anybody who has ever approached conditions of poverty knows what an extraordinary accomplishment that is. To end poverty and to create a healthy life expectancy that is already longer than the United States. China does have large differences of income, but those differences have actually crested and are starting to come down. I think that's very, very misguided in thinking that China is capitalist or even imperialist. Of course, China is doing developmental work. It has its Belt and Road Initiative. Between 70 and 90% are infrastructure development plans with, for example, African countries, as opposed to the massive resource extraction that you saw during the neo-colonial, neo-imperial phase that we see right now.
All right, so let's go back to the strategic pivot to Asia. Where does that term come from, and how does China fit into that?
The pivot to Asia, in its simplest sense, is an encirclement of China along the first island chain. It's surrounding China with 400 bases, essentially to take down China. And the U.S. explicitly gamed out that it was going to choke off China through the South China Sea. And if they did that, this would essentially destroy China's economy. That's 77% of China's fuel, and $5.3 trillion worth of goods travels through that. So the Chinese response to that was first to create defensive perimeters inside the South China Sea. The second project is that as they were being encircled, the Chinese planned a long overland escape route out towards other countries. This is the Belt and Road, the plan whereby China builds overland escape routes, primarily rail, but also some sea routes that bypass the bottleneck of the South China Sea, and they come out in the Indian Ocean and then towards the Persian Gulf, and also go overland all the way to Europe and towards Africa as well. This is a global chessboard that we're looking at. And the U.S., in distinction to that, has been engaging in what we call hybrid warfare. The kinetic dimension is shooting war, which could very rapidly go nuclear. But prior to kinetic warfare, you have pre-kinetic and sub-kinetic warfare, which are the different tools of trade, economic war, tech war, financial warfare, cultural warfare, diplomatic warfare, color revolution.
And today we're seeing this hybrid warfare you're describing as one of the primary methods of control against not only China, but Venezuela, Iran, other countries as well, right?
Exactly, yes. So this hybrid warfare has an economic dimension. The most obvious one that we can see is in sanctions. And at the current moment, about one-third of the countries of the planet are under U.S. sanctions. But also, we have to think about information warfare and cultural warfare and the ways in which ideology has been harnessed to bring around a fundamental belief in the inevitability of Western capitalism. This has been challenged by the Chinese model, first because the Chinese never allowed themselves to be assimilated into this Western model and this Western mode of thinking. At the highest levels, the commanding heights of their economy, the Chinese are still Marxist. That's very, very explicit in their constitution, in the way that their political system, their political economy is structured, and in the actual execution of their policy. So because of this, the West constantly is ratcheting up the hybrid warfare. And we see this in the kind of information warfare, the propaganda against China, for example, regarding Xinjiang, quote unquote, this genocide that nobody can find any proof of, or in this WMD type allegation that the Chinese created or spread COVID and therefore are responsible for the millions of dead around the world. Oh.
That was March for the Beloved, a Pan-Asian revolutionary song about the Gwangju massacre, performed by Nochasta. Now we return to journalist K.J. No. I'm wondering what you see as the U.S. endgame here. How seriously should we consider the possibility of a U.S.-China military war, whether it's conventional or nuclear? And to what extent is there bipartisan support for that kind of military warfare?
The first point to make is that the United States has already been at war with China at least two times. In 1950, during the Korean War, this was a proxy war against China. And of course, in the 1960s, in the Vietnam War, McNamara came out and stated, our war against Vietnam only makes sense if we understand it as a war of containment against China. The U.S. is doing everything humanly possible to prepare for a kinetic shooting war with China at the current moment. The key thing that I would point out is this escalation towards bipartisan. There's no lesser evil here. The imperial ruling classes cannot and they will not tolerate a rising or equal China in a multipolar world. They'd rather see the end of the world than an end to capitalism or white supremacy. There's an entire generation of nuclear weapons that are considered quote-unquote, to be usable in U.S. war doctrine. And since 2002, in the Nuclear Posture Review, the United States has explicitly prepared for nuclear war with China. On the other hand, the Chinese have disavowed nuclear first strike. But if the U.S. continues on this pathway, we could easily see that the Chinese would have to shift to hair trigger or launch on warning. And that could result in the end of planetary life.
And how is this hybrid war, particularly the information war that's trying to manufacture consent, how is that fueling white and male supremacist violence and xenophobia within the U.S.?
This wholesale hate-mongering and scaremongering against China and trickles down into retail violence on the streets so that you start to see Asian Americans here in the United States being attacked randomly. This is a very frightening signal. That lets us know that the fat is smoking in the pan, that we're very, very close to engaging in kinetic warfare with China. If you can randomly kill Chinese on the streets over here, that means we're ready to kill massive amounts of Chinese over there.
And how has COVID been used to also fuel the hybrid war and anti-Asian racism?
When COVID first arose, the general framing was that this was a Chinese virus and that this was going to bring down China. This was something that was created because China was so incompetent and corrupt and deceitful that it was perpetrating this health catastrophe on its own people, and that it would not happen in the United States because the United States is transparent and clear and democratic. So then when you started to see these massive death tolls and you saw how transparently the Western capitalist order was failing its people, then this Schadenfreude switched into a vicious tactic of demonizing the Chinese and blaming the Chinese for the failures of the Western capitalist system. The Biden administration has ordered the intelligence communities to come up with a determination within 90 days whether China is responsible for COVID. But if you were serious about an investigation into the causes, you would appoint a scientific panel, not the intelligence agencies. And this is the same type of information warfare that we saw in the run-up to the Iraq war, this WMD allegation that was filtered and stovepiped through the intelligence agencies. And I expect at the end of 90 days that we're going to find that China is responsible in significant ways for the massive deaths around the planet. And therefore, that will be one more justification for attacking China and going to war.
Let me ask you what thoughts you have about the importance of building global solidarity and anti-imperialist movements at this moment in history.
It's the most essential thing. We're facing probably one of the most dangerous moments, you know, in the modern era. We could see the end of humanity. But global solidarity is probably the only thing that can stop this machine. Without that, we don't really have a chance. I invite people to go to peacepivot.org. This is an organization I'm involved in. They have some good resources. Also, Code Pink and No Cold War also have very good resources. I think the Gray Zone has probably some of the best analysis right now. But despair is not an option. Speak up, make your voice heard, challenge, organize. We have to fight and challenge this escalation to war.
To listen to KJ Know's full conversation with Pacifica producer Ken Yale, go to covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy on Pacifica Radio. I'm Esther Evarim, your host for this show, examining imperialism, war, and militarism. And not all wars involve conventional weapons. In fact, the GrayZone.com investigative news website has documented many manifestations of hybrid war. Pacifica producer Ann Garrison speaks to the Gray Zone's Aaron Maté about the scandal of the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons releasing fraudulent reports about the use of chemical weapons in Syria. These reports were then used to try and justify the U.S., U.K., and France's aerial bombing attacks on that country.
Aaron Maté, could you tell us why you think the OPCW leaks are the most important story you've ever covered?
We're talking about allegations of a cover-up at the world's top chemical weapons watchdog to basically justify U.S. military strikes. And the evidence is overwhelming. So it's certainly the most important story that I've ever covered. And it's just incredible that it continues to be ignored by most of the media. You have this instance where the U.S. bombed Syria in April 2018, along with Britain and France, claiming that Syria was guilty of a chlorine attack. About a year later, in March 2019, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, comes out with a report that aligns with the U.S. narrative that Syria was guilty of a chlorine attack. But then you get this extraordinary series of leaks that would show that the actual OPCW team that went to Syria wrote up a report, found no evidence of a chemical weapons attack, raised major inconsistencies in the claims that chlorine gas was used, but that their report and their findings were censored. And not just censored, but in fact that their superiors tried to basically write a bogus report, a bogus version of their report, falsely suggesting that Syria was guilty. And that led to the standoff internally where the original team, led by the key inspector who wrote the original report, protested the censorship. And that resulted in two extraordinary things. First, a U.S. delegation came to The Hague, met with the team, something that has never happened before, to my knowledge, in OPCW history, and tried to convince them to basically ignore their own findings and conclude that Syria was guilty of a chlorine attack. And When that didn't work, the original team was basically taken off of the case and replaced by a so-called core team that consisted mostly of people who didn't even set foot in Syria. And since this has come out, what has happened? The OPCW has refused to address the documented scientific fraud. They refused to meet with the inspectors. And when you have people alleging wrongdoing and you have documents showing the massive distortions that took place internally, and you have a multi-year refusal to meet with the people lodging the complaint, what does that tell you? It tells you that there is something to hide. And what the OPCW is hiding is its cover-up. So it's basically covering up its own cover-up. And amazingly, the U.S. has been basically complicit in the cover-up, because with the exception of a couple of outlets like the Gray Zone where I work, the story has been completely ignored. So it's a story in itself, just given the facts of it. But then you compounding that, you have the prevailing media refusal to cover it, which makes it even more important for me to go after it.
To many of us, the U.S. war in Syria has been an abomination and a violation of international law from the beginning, with the covert support of forces that were trying to topple the government. Why is this incident so much more important than the others?
I'm not saying it's more important, but it's just so extensively documented. There are reasons to doubt all the previous allegations of these chemical weapons attacks by Syria. Just on the surface, they make no rational sense. Why would Syria do the one thing that it knows would invite U.S. military intervention, especially if you look at case after case when it's on the brink of victory in the areas involved, as was the case in Douma? But in the case of Douma, you just have this added component of a cover-up at the OPCW. You have the censorship of the investigation that actually got on the ground to investigate this. And all this effort now being made to ignore the inspectors who brought that cover-up to light, who challenged it from within. So I'm not saying it's more important. It's just so extensively documented, which makes the prevailing refusal to cover it that much more shameful.
Okay. Can you talk about ARIA formula meetings of the United Nations Security Council that you addressed, first on September 29, 2020, and then April 16, 2021?
Those meetings were held in the context of a prevailing refusal by the OPCW leadership and the states that bomb Syria, the US, UK, and France, to hear from the inspectors. And of course, what was the response from the states that have tried to bury the scandal? They don't address it on the substance. They just say that all of this is the result of Russian disinformation, and they change the topic. They bring up side issues like Alexei Navalny, which, whatever you think about that issue, has nothing to do with the OPCW cover-up. The reason why they don't want to address the cover-up is because the facts are so damning to their narrative, so they just have to try to pretend that it doesn't exist and change the topic.
This international institution, the OPCW, and international institutions that are supposed to rule on issues of peace, justice, and democracy, and determine whether or not atrocity reports are true, this is including like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. Could you say something about the importance of these institutions, even though they've obviously been corrupted at many points?
Even before this serious scandal, we knew that the OPCW was seriously jeopardized in its ability to carry out its functions independently. I mean, what happened to Jose Bustani back before the Iraq War? He was trying to bring in Iraq to the Chemical Weapons Convention. That would have been great for world peace, but it would have been a disaster for the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq, because it would have subjected Iraq to the kinds of inspections that would have undermined the Bush administration's pro-war propaganda. The U.S., because of its extreme power and financial leverage, was able to bully the OPCW into ousting its first director general. By the way, this happened shortly after Bustani's second term was renewed. So right after the guy gets a unanimous vote of confidence to a second term, John Bolton strolls in, threatens his kids, and manages to get him kicked out because he's standing in the way of the Iraq war. So that right there completely undermined the integrity of the OPCW. And so it's not surprising that 15 years later, the same sort of bullying is repeating itself. The U.S. was able to come in, have a very unusual briefing with the inspectors who went to Syria, meet them face to face, and basically tell them what they think that they should conclude. The fact that the OPCW's integrity is now compromised is not even in question, especially when you look at what the reaction has been since. In any normal case, when you have allegations of wrongdoing, especially these kinds of allegations, what's the obvious response? Investigate them. At least meet with the whistleblowers who are lodging the allegation. The OPCW basically has refused to acknowledge their existence. The only time they talk about them is to attack them in public and make false statements about them, as I've documented many times at the Gray Zone. So the OPCW is an organization with a major credibility problem. And it doesn't just raise a credibility issue with this particular investigation in Douma, but of all its other investigations in Syria, because it's very clear that there's an agenda here.
Norman Finkelstein said recently, with regard to the ICC, Human Rights Watch, and other international institutions devoted to human rights and international law, that these institutions are fallible because humans are fallible. He even said that 99 of 100 humans are corruptible. But he said these institutions have a lot of status, nevertheless. So you have to challenge them when they're wrong and cite them if they actually get something right, instead of dismissing them altogether because of their mistakes. Would you agree?
Yeah, of course. And in the case of the OPCW, the dissenters have been portrayed as people attacking the OPCW, which is not true. They actually believe in the OPCW's mission and purpose very strongly. They've spent a large part of their lives working for it and trying to carry out its noble mission of freeing the world from chemical weapons. What they're doing now is trying to protect it from political influence. So there's no contradiction here in saying that the OPCW has been compromised, but that if that issue is addressed, that it could be a noble institution. It's not irredeemable.
There's really no alternative, is there?
Yeah, there's no alternative. Yeah.
Aaron Mete, thank you for speaking to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Thank you for having me.
To listen to Aaron Mate's full conversation with Pacifica producer Ann Garrison, go to covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
And our media, you know, they have criticized Trump endlessly, every day, endlessly. Some of it justified, some of it not, but criticized him endlessly. But the one thing they celebrated him for, they were like, he's presidential now, is when he started bombing Syria, when he started releasing bombs out into the world. They were like, yes, that's our guy. This last time when he started bombing Syria, I didn't know what had happened. I came home, I flipped on CNN, and they were all so happy. They're just like sitting there smiling, they're giddy, they got their quinceañera dresses on, they were celebrating. And for a minute, I was like, did Malaysian Flight 370 land? Did it just come into Heathrow Airport? And people came wandering off like, oh my God, that was crazy. When they're having a so-called debate on war, on our infinite bombing, even when it's a debate, even the way they couch things, the way the terminology they use is designed to manipulate you. It's designed to make you think a certain way. So like they'll have a panel, right? And they'll have one guy who's like, I don't know if we should be bombing Syria right now. And then they'll have three guys, and one woman who say, we have to bomb Syria right now. And even though it's a debate, they keep saying terms like advanced weaponry, our advanced weaponry. It's not advanced to bomb, it's barbaric, all right? And plus, all these people were supposedly fighting over there, you know, no matter which country. We've created them and funded them and propped them up, whether it's Al-Qaeda back in the 80s, or we helped create ISIS. ISIS is using our weapons now, Al-Nusra. We helped Saddam Hussein until we didn't anymore, and Gaddafi until we didn't anymore. And it's like we're playing whack-a-mole over there, except no one mentions it's our own arm. You know, we're like, oh my God, there they are. Oh my God, there they are. Oh my God, there they are. Oh, they're everywhere. Yeah, they're using our weapons.
Comedian Lee Camp from his 2018 comedy special, Not Allowed on American TV.
War means tears to thousands of mothers' eyes when their sons go out to fight and lose their lives. I said war! Good God, y'all. I absolutely get sad again. Oh, Lord, Lord.
Food and access to food can also be a weapon, according to environmental activist and scholar Vandana Shiva.
I think the first thing to recognize about hunger is
that today it's a rural phenomena. It's mainly in third world countries, and it's mainly among communities that are actually agricultural communities. So why are people who are growing food going hungry themselves? They're going hungry because everything they have grown has to be sold in order to pay for the costly seeds and the costly chemicals. So a high cost chemical intensive agriculture is a recipe for hunger. Secondly, the models of agriculture that chemical farming has promoted are monocultures. Monocultures are nutritionally impoverished. The same acre of land, using biodiversity, using organic and ecological methods, could produce 5 to 10 times more nutrition than a monoculture can. So maximizing the production of commodities for international trade is directly proportionate to the decrease in nutrition availability to local communities, which is why hunger grows. If the world has to be fed, it has to be fed by growing food locally, to be used locally as the biggest proportion of the food basket. Some elements will be traded internationally, but what is traded internationally should not be staple foods. What is traded internationally should be that extra flavor of spices from India and coffee from Guatemala. That's all right. But to turn the world into a dependency on staples has nothing to do with feeding the world. It has a lot to do with controlling the food supply. The United States evolved a phrase during the Vietnam War, and the phrase was food as a weapon. The use of food as the ultimate weapon of control. And the tragedy is the growth of agribusiness in the U.S. has gone hand in hand with the U.S. foreign policy to deliberately create hunger locally in order to make the world dependent on food supplies through which you can then control countries and their decision-making ability. So hunger has become an instrument of war. And food responding to that artificially created hunger is an instrument of war. Peace means you grow food locally, you grow food with peace, you grow food non-violently, and the countries that are today the worst victims of hunger could be the highest producer of food. Africa has the largest land per human being, per capita. Africa is an abundant continent, and yet because of the deliberate policies, it has today been turned into a continent of hunger. India, which has the best soils, the best monsoons, the highest biodiversity, should not have any problem. We're growing enough food. And yet 70% of our children are going hungry because the economic system is robbing them of their right to food. So food production must once again be an issue of sustainability, taking care of the earth, and the human right to food must be an inalienable right. These rights cannot be ensured through a marketplace where food has become a commodity and a subject of speculation. We saw what speculation did in 2008. Food prices doubled, and the companies that control the food system doubled their profits. While riots took place in 40 countries.
That was activist and scholar Vandana Shiva.
We're gonna dissolve this Mexico Bethlehem war. If you hear us, heed the call.
And despite the range of weapons arrayed against those resisting imperialist domination, resistance continues. In the aftermath of Israel's May 2021 bombing of Gaza, killing more than 250 people, including 66 children, tens of thousands of Palestinians and their supporters converged on Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 29th for the National March on Palestine. Support for the Palestinian struggle in the United States is part of a global solidarity movement demanding an end to Israel's system of occupation, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid, demanding an end to U.S. military funding to Israel, and calling for a renewed campaign of boycotts, divestment, and sanctions to target the apartheid state. Zaina Ashrawi Hutchison, a Palestinian activist from the Virginia Coalition for Human Rights, was among the speakers.
I was raised in a city called Ramallah, but I was born, like my father before me, in Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine. I was exiled in 2009, and on my documents, Israel claimed that my nationality was undefined. Little do they know that we will return despite the racist manufactured pieces of paper and war crimes. We are here because we will not be silenced. We will not disappear. We are here to wake up people's conscience, challenge complacency, and call out those who empower ethnic cleansing of Palestine. But look at all of you. Look at the energy and power generated by the thousands in defiance of imperialism and Zionist settler colonialism. This energy that has engulfed all those around the world who have experienced or witnessed dispossession, oppression, and denial in its different forms. We are part of a community of conscience who reject the toxicity of racism and apartheid, who call out with us for freedom and justice, who bravely refuses to be complicit through inaction, and who took up the banner of freedom, dignity, and humanity for one applies to all of us. We will overcome adversity. Our cause is a shared quest, and we will redeem history. We will also not be fooled by hollow gestures and statements by politicians made as seat warmers for their political aspirations. And then behind the curtains of cowardice and betrayal, they fund Palestinian erasure and empower hate and discrimination. Hold them accountable. We are here to remind them that liberation is a right, not a gift.
That's right.
We don't ask for permission to end apartheid. We demand it.
That's right.
We don't ask for permission to return to our homeland. We demand it.
Yeah, that's right.
We don't ask for permission to free Palestine. We demand it.
Yeah.
They oppress us. We will resist. If they ignore us, we won't go away. If they imprison us, we will break our chains.
Yes.
And if they blow up our homes, we will rebuild. And if they surround us with walls, we will reach for the sky. And if they fragment us, Palestine unites us.
Yes.
Our land is our inheritance from our ancestors and remains our legacy for our children. From undaunted Lid to ancient Jericho, to captive Jerusalem, to besieged Gaza, to tortured Hebron, to Palestinian refugee camps, and to Palestinians and allies all over the world. Together we rise. Together we will liberate our Palestine.
Yeah.
But remember, dear friends, solidarity is not sporadic. It's a way of life. It's a commitment. So when we leave today, remember that you carry with you our hopes, trust, stories, and aspirations. Keep your head held high and walk beside us. Don't be shaken by intimidation. We will never stop until liberation and self-determination. Free, free Palestine!
That was Palestinian activist Zaina Ashrawi Hutchison speaking at the National March for Palestine, May 29th, 2021 in Washington, D.C. And she will have the last word on part two of our series on imperialism from COVID, race, and democracy. The show also included music excerpts from Edwin Starr, War, the Too Good Remix, and 47 Soul, Border Control, featuring Shadia Mansour and Fedzilla. Today's show was produced by Esther Ivarim, Polina Vasiliev, and Ken Yale. The executive producers of COVID, Race, and Democracy are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all other episodes along with our playlist and information about how to get involved at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I've been your host, Esther Ivarum. Thanks for listening.